We didn't edit anything for our first season. We were very proud of ourselves for that.
We didn't know how.
Yeah. We didn't know how, but also we were drinking drinks that people had sent us.
Yeah, people were sending us in drinks.
That were dangerous.
I don't know if you know Tripp and Fuller.
I don't know him personally. You know, I get his email of that. Yeah.
Yeah, he had a drink. It's called the Redneck Martini.
Do it.
It's Mountain Dew and
vodka.
And it's a drink that he got from working as like a volunteer firefighter or something, like in North Carolina. So like, cause he went to Wake. So like, I don't know this. It's something about North Carolina firefighters. Anyway, they drink it, which is terrifying in its own right. But yeah, so we did that, and that was our first drink, and man,
it was
a lot.
It was a lot. It was a
set the standard.
We're gonna do this.
We're bad.
It's great. I love it. It's such a great concept.
I mean, it's fun. So, you know, we're gonna introduce, now that we're recording, we were talking about, it feels like the elephant in the room to not introduce when we have a guest though. And we know you through our friend, mutual friend. He was like, you guys would all get along so well, you simply must. And because we do get told that sometimes, but when it's from people that we really like, we're like, that's probably legit. Like, so
thing to me about y'all, he's like, they're your people.
I love it. Tom is so great. And so I trust him to set us up with somebody also great, you know.
Yeah, he was my student at Perkins. So I was his professor.
I feel like since knowing Leah, the like web of meeting people, I've started to like, oh, like here are all these connections that I did not have prior to Leah. So it's been great.
I am a person I will not name for their own embarrassment purposes, that I had good Baptist breeding. So,
wow, that's a very high compliment. I mean, among all the compliments you could get, you should treasure that one.
I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church and then went to Shorter College, which was a Baptist college, and then went to Mercer and got my MDiv. So
I love it. And I went to Stetson University as an
undergrad.
That's how I became, but I didn't grow up in the church. And so, yeah, so my connection to the Baptist world came because at the time Stetson was a Baptist affiliated college. That's how I came into the world of Baptist. And in fact, I didn't know, I was 18 years old. I belonged to Baptist Campus Ministry. They got me into Baptist Campus Ministry through sports and all of that. You know, it's just funny because it was the first time in my life. I mean, I had been with Christians before I had a very important kind of Catholic priest. Like my friend was Catholic. I went with her to church a little bit. And so it's just so funny because my 18-year-old brain was kind of like, oh, if you want to be intellectual, like truth-seeking Christian, you know, you got to be Baptist. If you want to be intellectual and truth-seeking. So I did tell them at the Society of Biblical Literature and AR, like a number of years later, I'm like, well, I don't want to be offensive to all my Baptist peeps or whatever. But I'm like, I mean, you could have like helped a sister out and be like, yeah, no, extrapolate in such a fashion. But now it's too late.
Probably came about it. I mean, I'm going to make assumptions about our ages. Probably came about it at a similar time where there was sort of we kind of survived the Southern Baptists kind of back over or whatever. And there was a real questioning, I think, at least in my circles, of what was, you know, what it meant to be Baptist, and the fact that just because they didn't want us, it's not about you, it's me kind of thing. Just because they didn't want us doesn't mean that we didn't want to still be a part of this rich tradition, which I think is.
Yeah, but it's funny because I didn't know about any of that, right? Like that's
right.
I'm like, sure. I don't even know what that is. I don't know what a fundamentals taker. I don't know any of that kind of stuff. I'm just like here being a college student in this Baptist campus ministry, and now I'm Baptist. I'm like, oh, and even since then, I'm like, oh, wow, there's a lot going on here. Yeah,
there's a history. So, Christy, do you want to introduce our guest for us?
Yes. Well, firstly, welcome to Theology on the Rocks. We're here with a special guest, which we're really excited about. It's Dr. Jamie Clark Soles, and she is the professor of New Testament. And I don't know how to say this. Is it Altshuler? Okay. I'm a distinguished teaching professor at Southern Methodist University. Like Leah said earlier, we are being connected through our friend Tom. We're so excited to hear all about the stuff that you're doing. You're specializations are really cool and interesting. And we have so much in common, not just like personality wise, but also in terms of the research. It's funny because Leah and I both kind of joke about not doing anything with the Bible anymore because we're theologians.
We don't touch the Bible.
We leave that to the people who are better at it. But my favorite book of the Bible, the only class I took that was like a focused one when I was in seminary, is John. And so like I did the intro New Testament, intro Old Testament stuff. And then I don't even know why I did it, because it was not for my program or anything. I just decided like, I'm going to take this class on John, and I loved it. It was really great. So I think it's.
Can you say who you had? Who was your teacher? Or you can't?
I honestly can't remember. And she was an adjunct.
God.
She was also the only female professor that I had in seminary.
Wow.
So it's really sad that I can't remember who she was.
Yeah, to save you from yourself, I took my two classes, so reading your stuff, I was interested. Focus classes were John and Revelation.
I love it.
And John was taught by Dr. Alan Culpepper.
Yeah.
And he had started seminary there. And everyone was like, he is the goat. I hadn't even taken New Testament yet.
Wow.
Yeah. And so because I was a freshman, but I was scared he was going to retire, which come to find out was unfounded. He retired like last year or something. So I was like, you know.
Ish,
right.
From this faculty, maybe, but certainly not from the Johannine scholarship
world. Oh, for sure. So anyway, I took his class. I'll never forget. I've never had a class like it. He came in. He had no notes, not a PowerPoint, not a note, not a piece of paper. And he said, okay, John 1:1. And he read it in Greek from his brain. And then he read it in English. And he was like, all right, let's go. And I was like, oh my gosh, am I going to have to memorize the Bible
in Greek?
Seminary?
In Greek.
In English? I thought that was just like what people did, because I hadn't taken a class like that. And then I had Dr. Tom Slater for Revelation, but it was, you know, and that was just a cool class, because that was just like sit in a circle with like five people and let's talk about how people screwed this up real bad.
That's a great summary. Was that on the syllabus? Like,
I think that was his opening
outcome. Like, no, understand how people have screwed this up
so bad.
That's
fine. Okay. The cult Bible book, but whatever. So yeah. Did you remember your John person now?
No.
Oh, okay. I was giving you a time there, but.
It does actually go to show, I mean, it was something I would argue all the time, right? I mean, obviously the teachers matter, like you just said about Alan, but yeah, that text, I mean, is really powerful. The number of times people come up to me and kind of say, you know, like the effect they've had from reading it, even like, what is the Gideon's Bible, you know, you find in the hotel room? I mean, yeah. Just whatever, people happening upon it and reading it. And I was like, I don't know if that would happen with like the book of Hebrews. I don't think so.
Can you imagine if like Matthew really got you? Like
Matthew, we could talk about Matthew. Matthew,
all those, it's all those candlesticks, all those horses, and you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Why? Well, that's a question though, because that's one of your specialties, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. Is Revelation, or have you studied Revelation or written about it?
No, I have written about it some. So sometimes I write on Revelation, typically like that, when it's somebody's asking me to do the Johannine literature, more so than a Revelation. But I do teach a class on evil, suffering, death, and afterlife here at the seminary. Ooh. That's really popular. And then, of course, we spend a lot of time on a Revelation because, you know, it loves kind of hell and second death and, you know, all of these kinds of apocalyptic things. So I don't publish as much in Revelation proper as I do on, say, John and the epistles.
Yeah.
What's the popular class, do you think?
Yeah, probably the evil class. We call it the evil class. I call them my evil students. I don't let them call me the evil professor. Like, I draw the line. Like, I'm students.
I noticed you also do work with disability studies, and was a section of my research when I was doing my PhD as well. And I think it's really very good, like, kind of important. Is that what led you into your most recent work with the psychedelic therapy, or is it something
else? It certainly overlaps, you know, as what you're talking about, all the stuff with disability, all the ethical questions, what we do as Christians, what we do with the biblical texts around all the healing stories. So I was in part of a study at Johns Hopkins with religious leaders specifically, because, you know, I'm sure probably your audience is aware. I'm trying to learn what people are aware of and what they're not aware of. Continue to be kind of surprised as to how unaware Christian leaders are, especially about the psychedelic renaissance and what's going on for in their pews. We can get into that more. So that's how I got into the conversation, was the fall of 2017, was participating in a study. So they had done, you know, there's all kinds of research going on right now. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, you can find hundreds of studies going on for every medically things like, you know, addiction, PTSD, major depressive disorder, you name it, study going on. But these, they were doing a set of studies they had done of people who, I don't like this phrase, speaking of disability, so this is not my language, but they call healthy normals. So that is somebody who doesn't have any kind of medical or psychiatric diagnosis. They did novice meditators, then they did long-term meditators, and then they're like, we wonder what would happen with religious leaders, because typically folks, especially on psilocybin, which was what was used in the study, often have mystical encounters. And so they were curious what would happen with people who already, I mean, even people who don't consider themselves religious, kind of curious what would happen with people who do consider themselves religious and how that would work. So I was part of that study, which how I, and you had to be psychedelically naive to participate. And I was extremely naive. So so
that's what does that mean, psychedelically naive?
So never having taken a psychedelic.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense though, because they want you to have like the first experience there. Yeah.
What was the expectations and kind of blank slate kind of thing?
Yeah. What was it like? I read, and I know you have several links on your website to articles and interviews and stuff, but could you just tell us a little bit about what the experience was like for you?
And also how you got introduced to, not to interrupt you, Christy, I'm just like, how do you get approached? So
how did I get in the study, do you mean?
Yeah.
I've come across a number of our colleagues now in life who knew about the study and then somehow weren't able to be part of it, partially because, you know, you also have to balance these things out, and as we all know. How I came to know of it is a colleague who teaches mysticism, not at Perkins. So yeah. Who works in this area, and he was not psychedelically naive. So he passed it on to what turned out to be a mutual friend. He's like, hey, do you know any clergy? You know, this would appeal to you. And so this friend just sent it to me. So I read it and I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, it said Johns Hopkins. I mean, that's a major medical school. It's legal. It's safe. Right. And I'm an academic, like we're all academics. So yes, to advancing human knowledge, right. So, but also seminary professor and ordained clergy. So also super curious about anything to do with the mind, the soul, states of consciousness. How does that work? Right. What is that? It's in our tradition. So of course, I was just like, yeah, why not? But it was interesting because people I asked, not my current pastor, but one of my former pastors, like basically the first five people I asked were like, oh my gosh, don't do it, from kind of my church folks to my academic colleagues to an osteopathic doctor. They were just gonna have like a flashback, you're gonna jump off a building, you're gonna, your brain is gonna fry. Somebody was like, anyway, people were very, this was beginning of 2017.
They also told us we would die if we had sex.
Oh, and I was like, wow, people were talking to you. So true. So I went back to this colleague who first, you know, had sent the advertisement out. I was like, oh my gosh, like even our academic colleagues, I thought academics would be like, wow, this is Johns Hopkins. Like, this is pretty awesome. And he's like, yeah, no, we don't really talk to people about that. Yeah. Like people are, I'm like, why? And so then I started doing research and understand like why, and war on drugs and like all the kind of, all the stuff, you know, Timothy Leary, 60s, all this kind of stuff. So yeah, that's, so the experience, I was very heavily screened, right? Yeah. So I was very heavily screened, involved a lot of psychological screening, physical screening, et cetera. And then when the time finally came, I was given a high dose of psilocybin in 1 month later. So they see how that goes. And then 1 month later, you can choose the same dose or a higher dose. So 1 month apart. So I had two experiences 1 month apart in the fall of 2017. And each one lasted, a good 6 hours, 6 to 8 hours. I mean, it's a big undertaking.
And you're in a place, they put you in like a safe place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If anybody watches the Netflix series, How to Change Your Mind, based on Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, there's a Netflix series that came out a couple years ago. And episode number 2 shows you the exact room I was in, like with the white couch, that blindfold and the headphones, the playlist, what they call it, set and setting. So what is the intention of the person and what is the environment? Because that affects very heavily. Yeah. The kind of experience people have and whether it's, you know, safe mainly. So yeah, it was funny. You get a kick out of this though, because I told it said that because it's a study, you know, they had a blood pressure cuff on me and all of that. And I was talking to the doctor. I was like, wow, people ask about this. People are kind of freaking out that I'm doing this. And people are like worried I'm going to die. He goes like this. He's like, ma'am, you're at Johns Hopkins Medical School. you couldn't die here if you tried.
I was going to say, that's amazing. Exactly what I had in my head.
They're gonna make sure you're okay. I mean, if you're gonna try drugs for the first time,
right? This is not your Uncle Carl's basement. Like, you are
the local rave. Nothing against raves, because I also the whole culture with its own spirituality and all of that. But yeah, this yeah, it was really profound. I mean, I'm among the people you'll read this if you read in this literature. It's a huge field at this. It's got lots of prongs to it, but it's actually not uncommon. So I'm one of the people, you know, for whom I consider one of the top 5 spiritual experiences of my life. And that's the majority of the people in this study, and also meditators, had those kinds of numbers. And what we're seeing, I'm on the Emory Center for Psychedelics and Spirituality, which is just an amazing organization to be part of. Oh my gosh, my mind is like blown daily. It's amazing the work that's going on at Emory. And they published a really important essay in spring of 2023 talking about how CERT experiences, so spiritual, existential, religious, and theological, we're calling that CERT now. There's a lot of acronyms in this world. It's not just that people are having those experiences, but studies are showing that those experiences themselves are tied to better outcomes of healing of depression, anorexia, right? So it's not just like a byproduct. Yeah. People ascribe that experience, even people who are not kind of overly religious, they consider it. So that's pretty interesting. And it's something I think the church really needs to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so fascinating to think about how just the kinds of things that we're trying to deal with mentally, right? I mean, there's just, and I don't have any, this isn't my field at all. So I'm kind of going off of stuff I've just seen, but like increasing anxiety in general, increasing depression in general, like all of the just, and we're being bombarded by 24-hour news cycles that just make all of that worse. And so like how different ways instead of the kind of standard talk therapy can help us.
You know, they're really impressive. I mean, obviously all this comes with caveats and nuance that we would need to get into, but yeah, I mean, it is kind of, you know, the next big wave in mental health, because the results are pretty impressive. I mean, we have 17 vets a day die. We have 13 million people in America suffering from PTSD, and that's just 2020. So those figures from 4 years ago. So it's quite real. I mean, people around us are suffering at, you know, pretty deep levels, and then not to mention BIPOC folks who are under pressure. There's just, it's a lot. And yet I feel like the church is not, I mean, people keep, and I'm not saying this in a critique kind of way, but I kind of am, this notion that this is a fringe topic, and it's not fringe. And as long as the church keeps acting like it's fringe, first of all, the people in your church who are getting psychedelic therapy are not going to feel like your safe space to talk about it with. And the other thing is, because legally, so we could talk about the whole war on drugs, but currently something like psilocybin, when we're talking about psychedelics, we could talk about exact substances we're talking about, but take psilocybin, for instance, it's currently a Schedule 1 drug, which by definition, a Schedule 1 drug means that it has no known medical use with a high potential for abuse, neither of which is actually true about psilocybin. And so there's the scheduling issue.
Yeah, they'll prescribe opioids like they're candy.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think people need to start thinking about a lot of things. One is, what do we even drugs? So again, the war on drugs, which of course also has, you know, racial history to that. But, you know, I get concerned about, and again, I'm not a teetotaler. We're like doing theology on the rocks, right? So
right. Speaking of, we are doing a mocktail today, though, which is
we are doing a mocktail. Yes. Yep. Thank you. Thank you for accommodating that.
No, anytime. It's a nice coconut lime
cucumber. I feel like I need to do yoga.
Really?
I feel like I could.
Go to the spa, Leo, now. Oh, like the lemon.
Absolutely. Now you're talking really.
I'm always in search of the best coconut, like the best coconut kind of, you know, but alcohol is an actual hard addictive drug. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a Schedule I drug. So how we even conceptualize, and especially within Christianity as well, and our policies and ethics, what constitutes a drug and what do people freak out about and what do they not freak out about? Like people are popping this and that, sleeping pills, like whatever. And I'm not against that. But I'm just saying it's interesting how we conceptualize and then we're like, my gosh, psilocybin, right?
Well, I think it's okay to criticize our responses to things and it not be a criticism of sort of the thing itself, you know, because we socially, it's like, I'm not even sure if weed is illegal in North Carolina anymore.
Right.
And I say that with the sincerity, like marijuana as a certain version of it is illegal, but then you get the THC drinks and people are the California sober is, I guess, what they're calling it now. And I don't care about it. Do it. It's just, what are we, the other side is, what are we fighting here? How do we view it? You know, is it like, because it's becoming, I mean, we've got all these things opening. It's like the cannabis hut is down the road for me. And I'm like, cannabis hut? Are we, so we're not paying the sketchy guy down the road, the $50 for fake weed anymore? Like, what is happening? We got a hut. So I think it's a lot to do with the how we view those things. And you're quite right. I agree with that. It's like how society has accepted or rejected certain aspects.
And what they associate, who they associate which substances with, which people groups.
Yeah.
Because like, so I'm from Colorado. I was telling my aunt while I was evacuated, because currently on the ballot for Florida is legalizing recreational weed. And I was like, hey, this is going to be my second time voting for legal recreational weed, because I was in Colorado when that got legalized. And it's funny because a lot of the kind of ads and stuff against it are like, don't become Colorado. We don't want to become Colorado. And I'm like, what if this is true of Colorado? Like, it was actually great. It helped the economy. There's a lot of stuff that it's helped with, but also like, you know, they can kind of regulate if you're driving high the same way that we do with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Weed itself is being regulated better, so you're not just buying from the guy down the street and it's sketch and gross, you know. It's like,
I feel like I'm exposing a lot of my history through these anecdotes as we go.
I know, also sexy, but in this case I really do, it's a primer, because I am truly having, you know, like that movie 50, you know, it's like I'm having 51st conversations. Like, it's literally on NPR, Netflix, your Discover magazine, anywhere you turn, this is there, and it's not cringe. So I'm writing this primer, honestly, because I have this conversation all the time, and I want to be able to hand somebody something and say, read this first, and then let's have a coffee that can be, instead of me just saying really basic things, just read this, and then let's talk about something substantive, like, what about this? So there's certain actual policies within denominations that basically tell your parishioner, in a way, you can't be a good Methodist and get your psychedelic therapy. It is totally legal. So there's that level. But I want Christians to know about the medical therapeutic context so they can understand what they're talking about when they tell a parishioner or fellow congregant or whatever, yes, I support that. No, I don't support that. Please understand what you're talking about. Get some facts, because there's a lot of facts available. Second piece has to do with spiritual formation. So as these become more legal and available, see Colorado, Oregon, I mean, already people are doing things underground and people go to other countries, but as it becomes more legal in the States, more Christians are going to and are exploring psychedelic substances for spiritual formation purposes. And that's being done in individuals and in like a Christian group retreat setting. In other words, inside a Christian container. So inside my own tradition, instead of like Burning Man, again, nothing Burning Man or any of that, but like Christians going to Burning Man, that's one thing. But Christians wanting to kind of explore within their own mystical tradition, going deeper in their own faith, and so how do we do that well? How do you help people do that well? How do you help them prepare for it? Session. And the most important of any of these journeys, mine included, in a way, is not really the session itself or the journey itself. It's the integration. really big therapeutic for healing to happen. And it's important for spiritual formation purposes. And so to do that, we have to have knowledge. So part two is spiritual formation. Part three is justice, because there's a lot of justice and ethics pieces to the whole psychedelic thing. Back to BIPOC folks, who has access as these become available, already getting legal access to it, who doesn't have legal access to it, all of the justice issues, right relationship with the earths. So there's a whole justice thing that's deep and
important. I was gonna say, you've got a lot of stuff you could write on.
That's, oh my God.
Arms and legs.
The fourth area is harm reduction.
Yeah.
The fourth area is harm reduction. How can the church be knowledgeable? So the church can help vulnerable space when you're on a psychedelic. And you need to be sure that wherever you're going, you're in the safest possible setting. But the church, people have to know things before they can advise people to reduce.
I have a million questions, but there's three. So I'm going to put a flag. But the first one is, do you think part of this issue with people not being as accepting, you brought up the views of drugs and also people of color, which I totally agree with, but I wonder if, because Christy will tell you, I love the history as well. I wonder if it goes back to the history of how we view mystics and this idea of the mystical experience. I wonder if you think there's any, like, just the way we view mystical experiences as being, like, crazy or whatever.
It's interesting, when I first, in 2017, and now I'm very open in public now, and I had an essay called Psychedelics, the Bible, and the Divine. I don't spend a lot of time going into like what happened in my journeys, largely because, you know, it gets kind of navel-gazy. And, you know, Houston Smith has a really important quote, says a spiritual experience does not constitute a spiritual life, you know, or a religious experience constitute a religious life. If people are interested in some examples of things that, you know, why it was so important to me. But generally speaking, I'm more interested in kind of what it all means and what do we do and how do we deepen or become deeper. In my case, the Christian people. And yeah, so I think the mystics, let me put it this way. One of the first people I told about my experience, and I was like, wow, because when I went in, they're like, okay, think about clergy. They're trying to help you with your expectations going in. So you leave yourself to be very curious, like go in and just be curious. Don't come in here like demanding, I need to have this and I need to see Jesus and, you know, whatever. They're like, clergy sometimes want to kind of like have a beatific vision, this kind of stuff. Well, if you see a monster, ask monster, what are you here to teach me, instead of running away? So I was ready to be epic and slay dragons and go on quests. And I ended up having some very holy, very majestic, awe-inducing, deep experiences of humility in the best sense of the word, deep sense of belovedness, direct encounter with God. And not just once, but twice, like among a lot of other things too. There were some hellscapes in there and some forgiveness stuff I learned that I hadn't dealt with. But anyway, so I was telling a friend afterwards, who's also a Baptist minister, you know, that I had this kind of direct encounter with God. It was so overpowering, so overwhelming. I mean, really, truly, I was like breathtaking and speechless. And I just, I mean, I can feel it again in my body. And all I could do was just kind of say thank you and all of that. So first of all, the mystics. So there's the question of authority and gatekeeping, I think, of our religious tradition. Who has the authority to directly encounter God and mediate those experiences? What is our ecclesiology? What do we actually think we're doing at church? I mean, what do we think we're doing? Expect when we show up. Why is that threatening? And again, these are the questions you're asking the mystics, right? They threaten authority. They threaten hierarchy. You could look at them as threats, or you could look at them as what? I mean, what would you say? Like the beautiful way of like, wow, God available to everybody in all places at all times. You know, when I've done this, I do this presentation all the time. Now I talk to clinicians. Sometimes I talk to like secular clinicians. Sometimes I talk to Christian clergy. Sometimes I'm talking to like Christian clinicians. I'm like on the road talking to all people at all times. What comes up a lot with Christians, so people will say, well, and this, I guess, we're the mystical. So I'm Protestant. You tell me, you're theologians. Would you say that Protestants are less comfortable with mysticism than, say, Catholics and Orthodox?
100%. Yeah.
Protestants are so like rational brain.
Because I would say the Reformation stripped Protestantism of a lot of the anything that wasn't tangible, readable, touchable.
It's the same kind of effect that the Enlightenment has, right? Like everything has to be very scientific, and we get rid of that kind of spirituality, nature-based understanding. And so
you can't measure it.
Yeah.
I also think there's a gender piece to it, right? Because mystics, you have female mystics who are upending hierarchies or whatever, because they're saying, oh, I'm experiencing God and God is speaking to me. And so all these things to me get tied together also with patriarchy, to be honest. Like, so when things are in the body instead of in the mind, associated with the feminine, the mystics, even the sexual language, right? That gets in there. It's like scary, very embodied. And I think people are starving these days for any kind of embodied religious experience. Now, understand me, I am not a psychedelic evangelist. I am not tell people to go do psychedelics. I'm not, but I'm here for Christians to learn about it. And so whatever they're saying, whatever they think about it, it's informed and they've given it some thought. So yeah, in my experience, I mostly hang out with Protestants and there is a suspicion of the mystics. So in the article I published in the spring, I actually show 2 Corinthians 12. I walk through 2 Corinthians 12, you know, where Paul says he was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, God knows. And he has what we call in the psychedelic clinical study world, a challenging experience, where he asks for the thorn in the flesh to be removed 3 times. And of course, God says, no, my grace is sufficient for you. So whatever, I use 2 Corinthians 12 to kind of map this out for modern day psychedelic science kind of thing. It's funny, I was doing a thing for a Christian organization. They were filming this little video of me about the Apostle Paul. So I was like, oh, he's a theologian and a church planter and a mystic and whatever. Stopped the video. What do you mean? I was like, he was a mystic, you know, 2 Corinthians 12. He had these mystical visions, you know, Damascus Road, according to Acts. I mean, you can't say that on this video. They just really seriously would not let me call Paul a mystic, which is interesting, right?
They explain why at the time, or were they just like,
I think it's just what you all said. I mean, I think they didn't have to explain. They're kind of like, why would you say that? That's crazy. Like, Paul is a thinker. He's a theologian. He gave us doctrines and, right, rules about how to be church. This kind of crazy thing sounds, you know, because it was a very Protestant, you probably sounded too Catholic. And some of my Baptist peeps are like, you know, whoa, that sounds kind of Catholic. You
and
know?
What else, if women are having visions of God, why can't they be priests and ministers?
So that I'm working on that isn't under contract right the second, because it's gonna take me a little longer to write, is called The Agony of See and the Ordinary, Experiencing God in the New Testament. Which does, by the way, Christy, come from disability. Like, just where are our bodies in all of this? Because biblical studies is really big into this. But yeah, you know, just the whole question this day and age, where are bodies in our tradition and in our lived religion? Like, our actual practice of religion, when all three of us, like, whatever, when you go into religious community, where's your body in that service? And I think helping people even understand that there is a mystical tradition. And also from Genesis to Revelation, I mean, biblically, there's burning bushes, there's talking donkeys. I mean, it's all in there. Dreams, yeah. Joseph making life decisions based on dreams, you know?
I mean, yeah. It's so like weird to me to ignore those parts of it and to just be like, everything is scientific. But I mean,
well, we're hitching our wagon to the supernatural. And then when the supernatural appears, we're like, oh no, get back in the book.
Yeah, don't. Nope. It's like, I've always leaned a little, I'm not a mystic for sure, but like, I feel like that's the part of me that I like, if I could just do anything, I just like go ahead and just be a mystic.
How come?
I think it's that I'm very rationally brained and like all, but there's this like desire to be less so and desire to like, just say, you know, I'm just going to go live in the woods with, I don't know, maybe this is the Colorado coming out in me. Like, I'm going to go up to Uray and like.
That desert life would be rough on you.
I know. I'm not going to be successful at it. Me and my dog are city people, but.
Look at your dog in the background. How would Penny do?
I took her to the mountains twice and she was like, no, ma'am, no. But it's appealing in a lot of ways. And too, like, because my specialty is literature. I think I like the more poetic kind of romantic ways of, not romance like romance, but romantic in the
sense of. Yeah, what's I saying? Like you said, poetry, I mean, metaphor, prose, and it's not, it works on us into music.
Yeah.
Right. And anyway, there's a history in our tradition, and we do things in some traditions, not so much Baptists, you know, but like fasting. I mean, there's things Christians already do, incense. You know, I've been in some, you know, our tradition typically do drumming, but like I'm talking about even without medicines, drumming, breath work. I mean, I've done a breath, holotropic breath work thing that was amazing. Again, you know, one thing that's interesting to me as a Baptist is we love a good conversion story. Baptists love for people to get converted. And I had one of those experiences. I was in Baptist campus ministry and I was away at a retreat, a place. And, you know, there's a sermon, revival, what do you want to call it? You know, and I ended up really committing my life to Christ in that week. I mean, there were obviously steps leading up to it. It wasn't out of nowhere. We could look back and see. But that was the moment I went out into the woods and I had what I would consider a real encounter with the real God. And, you know, basically me and God, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Because I got a lot of questions and I can't really sign up for this thing till I get some answers and whatever. And whatever. I finally made a decision. Okay, do it, jump in, and then spend the rest of your life figuring out what it is you just committed to, which is, you know, what I've done. And in fact, I have based my life decisions, my career choice, et cetera, on that experience that was not rational. Right. And so people are like, well, was it real? Of course, you were taken away out of your regular life. There was, it was aimed at working on you, manipulating you, and then et cetera. Was it real? You know, I don't know. You're the theologians. We can talk metaphysics, but all I know is it was real enough that it has actually directed the whole course of my life. And here I am having a conversation with you. So I feel the same way about my journeys, my psychedelic journeys at Hopkins. You know, were they real? They gave you this pill. Is God in a pill, et cetera, et cetera? Is it just in your mind, you know, et cetera? These are all big questions that you all spend your life on, which is metaphysics. Like, is God actually real? Is what happened? Projection in my brain, it wasn't really, or you could also argue, and people do, look, the sign of Gospel of John, the signs are all around all the time, bread, fish, you name it, there they are. The woman doesn't have water in chapter 4, Jesus gives her living water, like there's water and there's water, the signs are all around. Is it the psychedelics actually, you know, each psychedelic works a little bit differently, but you know, they make connections in your brain. Does that actually just allow you to tune in to what's already there, right? Is it a fake projection, or is it actually shutting down the noise, you know, shutting down the noise and opening you up and making connections so you have a chance and a space to actually tune in to the divine in a way that you typically can't if you're just trying to like drive in Dallas traffic to go to the grocery store. We can't really have you like being mystical at the wheel, like, but it creates.
I mean, and I think it's a lot easier for, sorry, not to interrupt you, but it's a lot easier for me as a practical theologian to understand that in a way, because I think theology is a social construct. So I don't really like talk about if God exists to you, then God exists. That's fine. I don't even really care if God exists. It's more of a like, how do you, but with the systematicians, which I would say Christy is more of a systematician, I think it's those higher questions, you know, that do really matter. And I think it actually in many ways poses a more interesting question, I think, for the systematicians in a way, because it's like, what is real?
Right. And like, epistemology, it's also epistemology. What about revelation? How do we know what we know about God, and who gets to decide? Who adjudicates whether I know that to be true? The other thing I do want to say something, when the person was like, well, why would people go to church? It's back to your point, Leah. Why do people go to church? And what I think is so beautiful, and what Christian tradition has to offer the psychedelic space, it's two-way street in some ways, but we, and not just for Christian, we have a very long-standing tradition that knows about mysticism, like isn't freaked out, isn't scared for the most part. Like it's in our tradition. And at no point, even Paul, having Paul's mystical encounter, would never imagine it being individualistic and not needing community. And in fact, our tradition says, go have all the religious experiences you want, but then bring them back and let the community help discern. Because even Satan can disguise himself as an angel of light. So God told you to do that. Okay, well, was that God or was that Satan? Like, there is no such thing as being an individual Christian. And so when people are afraid that Christians are going to go, you know, participate in psychedelic journeys. And again, I'm not promoting that, but I'm saying if people are afraid it's going to pull them away from church or community, that's a very individualistic thing. That's my whole point. Christianity can actually offer the younger psychedelic renaissance that's kind of newer, like the fundamental importance of community. These things should not actually be done, in my opinion, or they're certainly not going to have as rich a meaning if you have no community before, during, and after to process this with.
I mean, even the four fractal freedoms, which is what we learn in Baptist life.
100%.
100%. They're individual freedoms, but they are freedoms that you bring to the community who then checks them. So you are indeed free to do those, but it is something that you bring and people chat about in an ideal world. And that's what the Baptist tradition is, sort of one of their foundational aspects.
Absolutely.
To kind of come back to this conversation about reality too, I think one of the things, so Leah and I both teach world religions, and it's interesting because neither of us are like properly trained in that. So you know, we learn as we go.
We're ahead. We teach a lot of things we're not trained.
Well, I guess we all do to some degree.
We do. We're good at reading and interpreting.
We're skilled researchers, so it's fine. One of my students actually asked me that this semester. He was like, why are you teaching us if this isn't what you do? And I was like, because I'm smart. It's fine. Don't worry.
But that's how you know you've been at it for a while. Welcome to the club.
One of the religions I teach in the beginning of the semester, we do in a couple of indigenous religions, and one of them is Yoruba. And I find Yoruba so fascinating. But one thing that I learned when I was studying is the setup for their epistemology focuses more on personal experience than kind of secondary or like what we would necessarily want, like facts or scientific proof. They're like much more concerned with how your personal experiences of things are truthful. And so it's an interesting way to come at this, because if you've had an experience and we're talking about like, how do we understand the realness of it? Well, your experience was real. Like it happens, and what it teaches you doesn't necessarily have to be, now I have new scientific fact about something. That's not what you're after. You know, it's here are the new, bigger, deeper truths that I have about God, about my life, about spirituality. Those are the important things, not this kind of like nitpicky, how old is the earth kind of stuff that we get so focused on.
Christy is a closet mystic, I think.
She's a closet mystic?
Yeah, she is. She's just been hanging around too many boys for too long.
I got stuck in addicts and haven't figured out how to get out yet, but
I love it.
We're going to pull you out. So a question from the science and religion perspective. This is a shout out to Myron out there in the world. He does science and religion, a friend of the podcast. When they do the psychedelic stuff, just in general at Johns Hopkins, do they do like brain scans at all? Like, are they scanning?
So not this particular study, but yeah, surely there's a lot of that going on. So with the fMRI technology. Yeah. And so they can show like what happens in the brain, which parts are getting lit up. Yeah. So yeah,
That's cool.
Doing a lot of that stuff with fMRIs because partially they want to understand there's a lot of things. There's science. And then of course there's politics and all of that. And so one of the things, one of the ethics pieces that the church needs to be in on, right, is right, where is greed come in when it comes to these conversations and availability? So of course, what insurance companies would like to prove is that it's not the therapeutic alliance necessarily, or the preparation and the integration that healing, but just the molecule itself, the way it functions, because it's a lot cheaper to just give somebody a drug, stick them in a room, like six rooms at a time, stick an IV in their arm and watch a monitor, is a lot less labor intensive and a lot cheaper than actually creating a trusting relationship, preparation, integration sessions afterwards, which costs money. And if you have two people, like a psilocybin journey requires to right now, like two people at all times, and it costs more money. So, you know, part of these, you know, everybody's got their angle on why they're participating in the studies. But from that perspective, there are those who would prefer to say that it's just the drug itself. I don't think that's true.
If somebody wanted, so that somebody, let's say, is listening to this and they're like, you know, maybe this is something I want to look into, what would you recommend is the best like first step that they take, or what kinds of resources are out there for them to look
at? Yeah, you can go to my website. I just have a new website launching. I haven't launched it officially, but it is out there and available. So I would check out, and there's a section called Psychedelics and Christianity. But my favorite place to send people first is Ligare, LIG. And it's the center really right now of Christianity and psychedelics. And so the resources there are spiritual directors you can hire. You can be part of group spiritual director. I mean, they don't host psilocybin, they don't host retreats or give you medicine, but they, the resources there for all the articles you want to read, conversations, they have monthly meetings. So wherever you're interested, you can jump in. I just got off of a call, a network called Transforming Chaplaincy. So tell people to look up Transforming Chaplaincy Network. So I'm part of the setting the competencies and rationale for psychedelic chaplaincy, which is a whole track. Harvard Divinity School is about to roll, will be rolling theirs out. So like there's palliative care chaplaincy. Now there's, we need psychedelic chaplains. So people who get their regular CPE training, but have specialization in psychedelic, you know, preparation and also facilitation during the session and integration. So I would say, look up the Chaplaincy Network, you know, join, ask to join if you're interested in chaplaincy. So Ligare, Transforming Chaplaincy, and the Emory Center for Psychedelics and Spirituality, which is ECPS. So look that up. And then I just got invited onto and participating in something called Pulse, Harvard Law School, which is psychedelic use, law, and spiritual experience. So that's a new initiative. So I'm in a new cohort of that. So those are four places I would go, all of which you can get to, again, I'm not trying to be like, but I'm trying to be useful on my website so that people can kind of, depending on where you're trying to enter this conversation, what's your interest, go this way.
Right. That's perfect.
I always self-promote. My supervisor, who was a woman, said, if you don't promote yourself, nobody will.
So yeah, no, I will post this in the show notes as well on Instagram so that you all can look these up. But your website is super helpful as well for all of this information. It's also, as I think I mentioned earlier, you've got some of your interviews and articles linked as well. So people can look at more of these too.
And we'd be amiss not to ask the question that Tom told us to ask.
I know. There's a final question that's just been burning away for both of us. Tom said that you studied or listened.
He said just ask her about
the David Koresh
tapes. David Koresh tapes.
You mean the fact that I subjected him to those in his New Testament class? Is that what he's referring to? So my dissertation is called Scripture Cannot Be Broken, the Social Function of the Use of Scripture in the Fourth Gospel. Because again, right? Like we have to do what we do. And so the dissertation was on comparing the Gospel of John to the communities at Qumran, which is a sectarian community, and the Branch Davidian community in Waco. And so comparing them to the Gospel of John and how they use scripture, how scripture functioned in their community. And so 100% when I teach the gospel, when I teach the book of Revelation, trying to impress upon the students how scripture matters in real life, that people like take the stuff seriously and you need to be doing this in light of culture. I actually have them listen to Bible studies on Revelation that conducted at Mount Carmel. And you can hear you can hear children like running around. So it's pretty powerful. I don't try to like be somebody who triggers students, but it is important to know things because mainly Christians don't pay attention to Revelation. They're like, whatever, it's weird. We're going to let weird Christians read that. You know, you're not serving people if you can't help people understand the book of Revelation in a way that leads to life. Give people options towards life. Don't give them the option towards death or dismissing. Yeah. But give them a way to read it, which is the way it was intended.
Yeah. Which is also like a great tie to what Leah does, because her work in bat theology is the same kind of like, how is this stuff being used poorly? And I think it's so important to talk about those things because Christians, there's either this like, I already know everything, I don't need to learn about it, or believe whatever you want to believe, it doesn't matter. And like both of those are a kind of willful ignorance that is ultimately really harmful, especially in this day and age when a lot of Christian nationalists are out there trying to manipulate and trick people who are probably really well-meaning.
Exactly.
Block people from being able to help other people in hurricane relief.
Yeah, like I mean... Stop telling people that FEMA is trying to block aid or that
Did you hear they had to stop in North Carolina because they're being threatened so much?
Guns. And there have been death threats sent to meteorologists about the hurricanes.
And they're stopping. What in the world?
Y'all are doing, and I mean this sincerely, the Lord's work, because it is important that we stop people from being manipulated in these ways and like are loud about what the Bible was really saying, what good theology is doing, all of that. And I think that's so important.
It's an honor to speak to both of you and the work that you all are doing. Like, it's just really important on the ground and also engaging, right? The way you're doing this to make this really available and show people, like, everybody's invited. It's everybody's job to know and do good theology.
Yeah. I think one of the things, especially Leah and I both were in such, like, and I'm sure you were too, such male dominated spaces for so
always.
And I, this is not like, well, it is a little bit of a dig to all of our men friends out there, but
hashtag not all men, Christy.
Not all men, but like, honestly, it's just so refreshing sometimes to have just some women that you can chat with and share your passions and also just kind of joke around about various crazy things going on in the world. But like, it's our favorite thing is just keep finding and encouraging and uplifting women. So,
and I do the papers for, this is just an anecdote, but I do papers for VP elect AR Southeast. And we had all of these, which, by the way, if you guys, anyone listening or indeed yourself, Jamie, if there's any student paper, well, you're Southwest probably, I'm guessing, but want to get papers in, please do send them. Anyway, point being is that this year we had a whole session on psychedelics and religion. And I thought to myself, because I didn't have a finger on the pulse. So I didn't realize that that was the thing that was, but you talked about the Renaissance. And I think that actually is, the students are certainly picking up on it because, you know, we had students from Elon, we had students from Florida State, you know, all across the board, private, public, whatever, who were doing these from very different perspectives, you know. Like one young woman did do her paper on Burning Man, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like what they do, she went to all the different festivals, have these like spiritual tents or like areas.
Zendo. Yeah, Zendo.
I'm sure you know. Like, yeah. It's not, but I just want to say the students are picking up on it and they're very interested in it, which is
very cool. Interested. And I'm even getting, like, I get so many emails now. Everybody, like, so somebody's a sophomore psychology major at a college and he wants to kind of go into this professionally as a medical doctor, all the way from clinicians who themselves are Christian, but, and this person's like, I've been doing psychedelic therapy as part of my practice, but I've been feeling really bad as a Christian, like that I'm somehow like doing something against, you know, our religion by doing it. So you're like allowing me a way to start thinking about how this can be part of my vocation legitimately, you know, so it's such an important topic. So yeah, I really appreciate your inviting me to speak about it.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite former NFL quarterback is now, he has a line. I can't remember what it's called. His name is Jake Plummer. He was the quarterback for the Denver Broncos, but he has a line of medical psychedelic, and he promotes it mostly for athletes and especially football players because of CTE and all that.
At, you know, the biggest meeting that happens, you know, like our AARSBL meeting. Yeah. So this world that's called MAPS, the MAPS meeting, a psychedelic science meeting, happens in Denver in June. There were 12,000 people last year. And there's 12, it's bigger than our meeting. It's from like neurosurgeon. And they always have like a whole line of the athletes. They had another football player, I can't remember his name, but he was there speaking about that, like on behalf of all athletes. It's so huge of a topic. You can't kind of know everything about everything. It's like, you have to figure out what's your part to know really well to do your part.
Yeah.
And it's such a thing that you think, like, I've watched that documentary, I won't promote it too much, about the football player who killed people, is like, how much of that could have got prevented? How much of a bunch of stuff could get prevented if we just like open our minds up a little bit to things, you know? I mean, not to make it sound super systematic, but there you go, Christy. There's your vague nugget of the day.
Nods to systematics every now and then.
I do. This weekend. And we will be doing a lot of stuff. I'll be talking about the Aliens franchise and then also world religions. And then also we'll be doing the Hot Wings Challenge.
With Tom.
Tom doing it with us. And we'll be answering your theology questions. So please do send them in. We'll try to answer. I rewatched our Hot Wings Challenge. And we answered like the first like three. And then after that, it was just chaos. So
horrible. I'm looking forward to it, Leah. Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, hey, this is wonderful. Let's do it again. But stay tuned for next week, or well, the Hot Wings Challenge, which we will be posting as well, and updates about Theology Beer Camp. And yeah, this was so exciting. Thanks again so much.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your time very much.
Thank you so much for having me.